You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Neil Shepherd, an American poet, essayist, professor of creative writing, and literary magazine editor. Neil Shepherd grew up in Leominster, Massachusetts. His website says, a billboard on the highway advertised Leominster as the pioneer plastic city, Shepherd remembers. The town often smelled of burning plastics, and the factories along the Nashua River blend a new chemical dye orange, purple, green into the waters each day. In the summers, I escaped to a family home on the main coast, Orchard Beach, a demure variation of Coney Island. The salt air, amusement park lights, and polyglot of languages on the boardwalk, including Yiddish, English, and Canadian French, enlarged my notion of the world and whetted my appetite for travel. Neil Shepherd's poems take readers on a journey across emotional as well as physical distances. His work has been critically acclaimed by reviewers and praised by his peers. An accomplished musician, Shepherd attributes much of the lyricism in his poems to his early musical training. I came to literature late, Shepherd says. I enrolled my freshman year at University of Vermont as a pre-med student. In my sophomore year, I had a spontaneous conversion during chemistry class. While fixating on the 20-foot chart of the periodic table, I suddenly began daydreaming the lines of poems, which I jotted in my notebook. By the end of class, I had determined to change my major. Neil Shepherd earned his MFA in creative writing at Colorado State University and his PhD at Ohio University. He has taught at Louisiana State University, Rider University in New Jersey, and Johnson State College here in Vermont. He currently teaches in the low residency MFA program at Wilkes University in Pennsylvania and at Poets House in New York City. And he is senior editor of the literary magazine Green Mountains Review. Neil Shepherd founded the Writers Program at the Vermont Studio Center and directed that program for 8 years. He's also a founding member of the poetry jazz ensemble PoJazz, whose CD, Last Days, is distributed by Tupelo Press. He has published 4 full collections of poetry, Scavenging the Country for a Heartbeat, I'm Here Because I Lost My Way, This Far from the Source, and Travel, Untravel, as well as a chapbook of poems, Vermont Exit Ramps. His poems and essays appear in several hundred magazines, among them Antioch Review, AWP Chronicle, Boulevard, Colorado Review, Denver Quarterly, Harvard Review, New England Review, North American Review, Paris Review, Shenandoah, Small Press Reviews, Southern Review, and Tri-Quarterly. When I spoke to Neil Shepherd when he was in Burlington to speak during the Burlington Book Festival, we talked about his collection, Travel, Untravel, published by Midlist Press, and the chapbook, Vermont Exit Ramps, published by Big Table Publishing. I began by asking Neil to read the title poem from Travel, Untravel, which is spelled with a parenthesis around each of those T's so that it also looks a little bit like Ravel, Unravel.
Travel, Untravel. You've met them, travelers half returned from afar, curled on a couch, comfortable, uncomfortable, worrying gifts from elsewhere, a tattooed cow skull, a friend's gamelan inlaid with bone and pearl, a chipped tiki from a tohua. You've seen them unravel as the other world spins into view. Perhaps you felt the vertigo too. The pig's throat slit, spit dripped in a kava bowl, maggots in a plate of noodles, squid's eye stabbed with a heke stick, its inky signature floating across the coral reef. How well you know the abrupt dislocation of matter. Firewalkers in Fiji, blue glaciers in Norway, eyes squinting in Tahitian sun, wide open over Mongolian grassland. Your gaze become the rose windows at Chartres, the glazed mosaics of the Alhambra. Your ear, the growing comprehension of Shanghai slang, flamenco shout, Marquesan pig grunt. Your hand gesturing toward the street, the sea, the rim of horizon, a white flash of surrender.
Thank you very much for reading that. That's such a wonderful poem because it sort of gives us a little overview of many of your travels. I won't say all because I'm not quite sure where all you've been. You've traveled all over, and the poems in this collection are a product of your experiences and observations. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about deciding to put this collection together.
Okay, and I will start. I started with the Travel on Travel poem, and if you take a look at the title, you notice that the T's are in parentheses, so that it's also ravel and unravel. And that's my sense, that is, as one travels into the unknown, into cultures where you don't speak the language, you don't understand the customs and the mores, you sort of begin to lose your own sense, your own bearings, and sometimes I feel kind of reduced to a little greasy spot, a little nub of personality, and I unravel as I go into these other cultures, and then at some later point, I kind of reassemble and write the poems. Sometimes when I'm still in the unraveled state, I try to get down as much just sensate information as I can, sort of a first draft, just to get things down when you are in that state of unknowing. And, of course, when you're in that state of unknowing and information's coming in and your filters are trying to select something to make coherence out of what could be just chaos, it's exhausting.
Yeah.
And oftentimes I felt like I needed two or three naps a day, just as an infant would when, you know, you're sort of first trying to assimilate the world and in order to take it all in. So this first poem, The Travel on Travel, tries to give an overview of a lot of the places we'll be visiting in the rest of the book. And it references Polynesia and China and some of the European places I lived, and other more far-flung places as well. And it's kind of like the envoy to the book.
Now, have you been to these places mostly, for the most part, just once, and then you're drawing on memories and writings from that one time, or have you been back?
Both. I've been to some places just once, but when we say once, I've lived for the better part of a year in China. I was teaching in Shanghai, and as my wife, who's a linguistic anthropologist, and I were teaching in China and learned the language better, we got to go on our own away from the big cities and out to the west of China. So, in fact, we traveled pretty widely over China and visited some of our students who were in Shanghai, but they came from the provinces. So in the summer, when they were back home, we would actually go to many places and then have a home base, mm-hmm. as it were, away from Shanghai. In the Marquesas Islands of French Polynesia, mm-hmm. We lived on a small island called Nuku'hiva. That is the same island where Melville jumped ship in the 19th century and went to live among the cannibals of Taipei, and he wrote an ethnographic novel called Taipei. And basically, it was, you know, a bunch of tall tales.
Those weren't true stories.
Well, he did stay in Taipei, is the name of the village, and he stayed there for about a month. But he claims in the novel to have been there about a year. He claims to have had a lover named Feiwei and a servant named Cory Cory. Neither of those names actually exist in Marquesan language, so he just invented those things.
And
did
he escape?
He claims to have escaped.
Yeah, that's cool.
And it was in the old days, you know, a place where there were cannibals. And into the 20th century and in the 21st, it remains a very tough place. It's unlike the happy isles of Oceania that Paul Thoreau writes about. This is not a happy place. Mm-hmm. It's a more warlike culture, and it's a very hard place to live. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he was there for a month. I was there for more like 8 months, and my wife had gone ahead of me, and she was there for the year. And we've been back several times, and in fact, I'm going back in 2 weeks.
To the Marquesas.
To the Marquesas.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. How long will you be there this time?
Just 3 weeks.
Okay.
So I've you know, when you say have I been there just one time, it might be one time, but it's been you know, it'll be for a very long period of months.
Right. It's a part of your life, as opposed to a visit.
Sure.
Interesting. Yeah. One of the things that I absolutely loved about the whole tea in the parentheses thing is that when we travel, you know, we do feel like we're partly in one place and partly still with one foot back home. And then when you come back home, there's a sense of still being part of that other place for a while before you settle back into your life. And I liked the unraveling sensation of these poems.
That was sure. Yeah, I mean, there is that sense that the traveler never quite returns the same again. My sense is I don't like to do tourist travel very much, and I've been fortunate enough to be able to go to places off the beaten track, to either, because my wife knows researchers in many parts of the world, will go to small villages and stay with them, and we're already sort of become part of the village life, rather than see the kind of sanitized tourist version of a place. We often try to find a way to go into the everyday culture. Mm-hmm. And but so when you see that and you're trying to make sense of it, if I think travel is doing what it can do so well, it should transform you. And when you come back, you aren't exactly the same person who left, and your own cherished certainties, you know, are no longer so certain. And, you know, you just see that it's really people throughout the world think about how they live day to day quite differently than you, and they're all viable models, and it's just really some sort of by accidents of birth and place that the world is as it is. So when you come back, you are both comfortable on your couch again and yet uncomfortable with what you now know, and the world can kind of slip. There can be a trap door that opens yet again into this other place, and makes you kind of, you no longer have this sort of cherished faiths and certainties that you might have had before.
Right.
You're less ignorant about the world, and you understand more about its multiplicity, and that is both good, but it's also can be a little more shaky about one's sense of grounding and identity.
Well, along those lines, I was going to ask you to read a poem that takes place in Ubud, Bali, called Monkey Forest Road. I loved this poem. I loved the idea that you weren't presenting Bali as this eat, pray, love paradise, but the real thing where there are beggars and there are people who are really struggling to survive, and they're relying on the visitors for that survival. So anyway, if you could read that, and then we'll talk a little bit about it.
Sure. And I'll just say a word. This was this is in the first section of the book, and the book is organized around it's a kind of a metaphor, kind of for a life journey, and a lot of the poems in the first section are what I would call initiation experience kind of poems, ones that I think more of almost like in one's youth, where everything is new and you know, very kind of heavily sensory, and you're taking things in for the first time. So a lot of the poems in the first section all have that heavily sensate quality to them, and I invoke the spirit of two poets who I think are invested in that kind of writing, William Carlos Williams, who one of his famous things was "No ideas but in things," and the other voice invoked is Walt Whitman. So that first section is filled with poems of sensate experience, and then on it goes into the more adult worlds of art and conflict, and moving toward older age, and through a death section, and into an afterworld section. That's the arc of the entire book.
Okay.
This is a poem in the first section, when I am a kind of a young traveler coming to Bali for the first time, in Ubud, and it's far from the glam coastlines and tourist haunts. Ubud, of course, by now has been discovered, but back then it was not. So, travel and travel, Monkey Forest Road, Ubud, Bali. Pinned under mesh netting, I awake to mosquitoes and geckos, brash anjing howling outside, fighting cocks bruising the air. The market's squawk is a block off, where women smelling of raw fish, their breasts burst from their shirts, and men hawking and emptying their nostrils on the sidewalks shout, "Mister, mister." This morning, I can roll over and refuse it. The Balinese begging, "Buy ticket to Kachuk monkey dance, buy wood carving of Garuda." Refuse, roll over, and burrow deeper into my wife's awakening flesh, into the blonde texture of her hair. Or I can attend today's dance of Ramayana, where women with pitch dark hair twisted back along their necks will imitate the flight of blue herons, where men chattering chuck, chuck, chuck will ape a troop of monkeys, while the gamelan players hammer hypnotic fire trance scales. I can refuse it all, the toothless woman who drapes her strained sarong around my waist and hisses 60 rupiah. The scarred guard blocking entrance to monkey forest, 500 rupiah, he says, and snatches it away. Or guards at the floating palace who forbid me to enter the puri, the temple, without the dignity of bare feet and spirit, dressed in sarong and sash. I can refuse even the holy men of the island who subsist on sunlight and quiet, teaching the body bathed in sensation that being blinds us, distracts us from the world behind the world. The sun won't clarify this hazy morning, which is why I will arise finally from this twisted simian knot and climb to a higher brain, asking, how will I meet those black eyes begging, Mister, Mister? How will I descend the steps to Gulung Kawi, where secret burial chambers of the monks have been laid bare? Labyrinths of honeycomb sarcophagi, corridors of deep quiet, dug down through sandstone, down under the rice terraces, the hand-dug canals, down to deep rivers carrying the rainy season away. How will I arrive there, unscathed and prepared? Or will I always arrive scarred and fearful, my meditations unraveling? And will I always succumb to the man with the machete who stirs his hands through my prayers as through muddied water and says, Mister, buy my coconut? Out the door, down into the streets with you, lost in the funeral dance on Monkey Forest Road.
Thank you very much. I think that's such a wonderful poem. It must be fun to be able to work with language like Gulung Kawi and, you know, the different languages that you run across in your travels, Ramayana.
Yeah. I think I actually had to make a decision at some point whether or not to footnote all of those foreign terms or to just let them be. And I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to use the language to show off, you know, like T.S. Eliot with his 84 footnotes in The Wasteland. I was doing it mostly because when I was there, the language made me feel a certain dislocation. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to induce that same sense of dislocation in the reader or hearer of the poems. And I chose just to put them there and hope that they became part of the flavor of the poem, the sound features. Sometimes when I was traveling, I would have a journal with me, a little pocket journal, and I would just write down things, and you start hearing some of the most useful phrases over and over again in the culture, and then you finally later learn what those phrases mean. So I tried to get the language down without even knowing what the language meant first, and I thought I wanted to get some of that into the poems. And so if later you, by context, can figure out that the brash Anjing howling are Anjings or monkeys, then good. But if you don't know that, well, at least you get one of the exotica, the moments of exotica in hearing that.
Yeah.
I think I put in, when I said we enter the puri without the dignity of bare feet, I said kind of temple, and I think I translated it for you. That last image about going out into the funeral dance on Monkey Forest Road, you mentioned you were there to me. The funeral dances, I mean, just they're amazing because a lot of people, it's an animistic culture.
Right.
And in this case, we were there when they were digging up a corpse. When someone dies and if they don't have the money for the funeral ritual, they bury the corpse and then later dig it up. And they put it in a papier-mâché cow. And then they hire professional mourners and others who are part of the family, and they go through the streets until they end up at the funeral pyre, and all of the people who are there can join along this route. We went with them, and they basically burn the cow. It's hung over the fire, and as it burns, the stomach opens up, and the body is birthed through the stomach of the cow onto the funeral pyre, and that's part of the ritual. But it's just, you know, the first time I saw that, I was just so stunned by it. And so I, at least, you know, this is a poem about heavily sensate experience, but it's also about being in the presence of spirit and death, and that was the last image I wanted the poem to end with.
But that's a great image. Yeah. Really something else. Did you see that many times then?
We saw it three times in the time we were there. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. I wonder if people who read these poems ever take issue with your interpretation of a place. And I guess I mean for this collection or even for the next collection we're going to talk about, which is Vermont Exit Ramps, mm-hmm. which, you know, you bring to it your own reactions to place. Do people ever kind of come up to you and say, I read your book, and?
No, in fact. People, I'm well aware that, look at every poem I write is reflected through my own experiences. Doesn't matter whether I'm writing about Vermont or where we are now, or New York where I live half the year, or some more far-flung place in the world. But certainly, you know, each of us I think that's probably what makes each voice unique. We have a certain, you know, set of experiences that we grow up with and into, and we appropriate certain kinds of language, and we have all kinds of, you know, biases, and some of which we're aware, some of which we're not, and all of these things, you know, make us respond to the world the way we do. So I don't expect my experience to be a universal experience. And in fact, it's fine if someone has a very different experience and wants to tell me about it outside the poem, and I will say, you know, sure, there are many poems about, you know, China. There are many poems about South Pacific. Go write your own.
If you're
taking umbrage with my interpretation, there's plenty of room out there in the world. I do the other questions about appropriation. How does one feel? How do I feel about appropriating another culture?
Yeah.
And then, you know, putting into a book. When we lived in the Marquesas, they were used to archaeologists coming and stealing their tikis. The tikis are their stone statues, and then putting them in museums, selling them for a lot of money. And so they think every Westerner coming to the islands is going to make money. That's all a Howie knows. We are Howies. We are white people. And that's a refrain of one of my poems about Melville. And so they accused my wife, the anthropologist, of wanting to just make money. Anthropologists don't make money, and certainly poets don't make money. So while I was appropriating their culture, I tried to be mindful of it. You know, always was aware that it was just a version of travel. And, you know, what I brought back, I hope, was some sense of entering into a much wider world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, perhaps trying to induce curiosity in the reader and making that person want to travel as well. Because I think after a lot of wide travels, as I say in another poem in the collection, The World Goes Away, with an epigraph to Emerson, I do think that travel is, you know, one way at least to launch you into a much larger world and to kind of shatter that self-enclosed ego structure that we have and to have this kind of confrontation with otherness. I call it sometimes the voice in the void. It's almost spiritual as well, where, you know, I think almost anything that enlarges the scope of your life is, you know, can border on a spiritual experience.
Yeah.
And I think if you can bring back some approximation of that adventure and make other people's lives who might be just, you know, more bound to the couch, if you can make them relive that adventure without even having to go there,
right.
I mean, that's what books do. Novels take us and poems take us far away from where we are in the moment, and they enlarge our worlds. And I hope that these poems, whatever they appropriate of the other world, at least will, you know, serve that purpose to enlarge the reader's world.
Yes. Absolutely. In reading these poems, I enjoyed sort of being able to figure out which places you had great experiences and which places maybe you didn't have the best experiences. But I also wondered, as a writer, if maybe some of the places that you went that weren't great experiences created great poems. Like, were you happier with some of the poems about bad experiences? I think that might be a really natural thing to have happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm part, you know, delightful person and part curmudgeon. And, you know, and I have my creature comforts, and when I don't get them, you know, I mean, I think sometimes I can get crabby. And it, there's a poem about China in this book called Kohler, which means sort of bile and anger. It's one of the four humors of ancient medicine. And so the poem is, it records a rather difficult moment in the travel in the west of China between me and my wife. And it was in the 1990s when everything was mayo. Mayo means not have.
Okay.
It was not at all like the superheated economy we now have in China, where you can get pretty much what you need. Back then, it was this scarcity of resources, and it was very hard to get anything, including tickets to go anyplace, including food. And so this records a moment when we're sort of stuck in the desert in the west of China and not able to get a ticket to leave it.
Why don't you read that one? That would be great.
Okay. So this is called Travel Untraveled Kohler. I have epigraph or dedications in a lot of these poems, and this one is for Robinson Jeffers, who himself was at times, you know, kind of a not very interested in human beings. He said, you know, more or less, he would be just as happy if there were none in the world and just, you know, a bunch of insects left. So there are three Chinese phrases that maybe you ought to know. Wo yao means I want.
Okay.
And Wei Guoren means Westerners or barbarians. Also, they call us Dabitzes, big noses. And Mayo means not have, don't have.
Okay.
Travel on travel, Kohler. We had come to the Great Wall's end in the desert of Jiaguan. Our tempers flared across the crumbled battlements out into the red heat. There were weeds, thorns, a few hard-shelled bugs, love reduced to a black carapace under which a stinger, a biting mouth, a reflex, a poison. Heat withered our patience. Our bowels, stung by a virus, made us say words we'd regret. Peevish, pernicious, wayao, wayao, I want, and nothing else. We both stormed off. Stormed could have brought some moisture to this desert, but no, this storm was a hot wind stinging sandstone in the face, chipped sandstone from the last outpost that would cut and bury us. Wei Guoren, barbarian. Stripped of camouflage, of greenery, fluidity, we showed every tick and flaw. I could not stand one more day of mayo, not have, not possible, not ever. I could not stand in one more ticket line, elbowing for a hard sleeper berth out of the heat. Come back tomorrow. Tomorrow and tomorrow, stretching away like the Great Wall disappearing into red dust. There was a Hami melon, the best melon in the desert, it was said. Pale green rind, and inside a thick, luscious yellow. Mayo to melons. Mayo, tahami, to anything but a few dry husks in the streets where others had stood ticketless for days. I could have spit in any traveler's face. I could have spit in her face and she in mine. I could have spit in the wind and hit myself and liked it. I could have tasted black bile in every phlegmy word launched against the dryness. Down beneath the desert in a crypt, I saw an ancient face preserved in this dry heat, shrunk to a withered visage, devoid of the good wetness that waters our lips with thanks, its lips turned down in an arid scowl for 4,000 years.
Wow, you were really cranky.
Yeah, and in fact, I did. I saw this mummified body and face preserved in the dry desert heat in a little museum way in the west of China. And, you know, I looked at that, and I wrote it in my journal, but at the time it didn't register at all that it was going to be part of a poem. But when I was writing this poem about difficulty and color, that vision came back to me of this withered visage, and it became the last image of the poem. Just perfect, this scowling look, and you know, because of the dryness and because of the lack of anything like fluidity and all of that good fertile stuff that seemed to be lacking in this poem. And you know, certainly Sometimes the poets are morally superior in their poems, but certainly it doesn't occur in this one. I mean, the poet is not always the hero of the poem, and it's certainly not here.
Okay. How long did it take you to get out of there?
We had I think it took us 2 days, and the line would form in the morning, at 8 o'clock in the morning, and there were no tickets. So everyone stood, and there was a long line. And then at lunchtime, they would just close the ticket office and say, we're going to be, you know, it was hard to understand what they were doing, but it came to be known that they were going to lunch and would be back in 2 hours. And so you did not have a queue, so there was no place guaranteed you. So you came back and you had to sort of scramble again for a place in the line, and then they would close up at 5 or something, and there were still no tickets. Or the tickets would come in such dribs and drabs, line would move forward a very little at a time. We ended up doing something like a reverse guanxi. Guanxi is a word the Chinese use to try to go through a back door to get a favor. And like they will give you something. Oh, my parents no longer need their television. Here it is. And if you could help us get a trip to America, that would be great. So somehow there was someone we knew who said, I can find another way to get you a ticket. But I think we would have been there for a week.
And was there anywhere to stay, or were you just sitting on benches?
No, there were places to stay. I mean, they were, you know, they were Spartan quarters.
Such as they were.
Yeah,
right, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. I wanted to ask you about finding the right epigraph.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these poems have epigraphs, and sections have epigraphs in the book itself. So do you go searching for them? Do you keep copious notes when you find something that you want to use down the road? Or how do you? I'm always curious how that comes about.
This book was special in having so many epigraphs.
Uh-huh.
It was a very determined book, and I had a sense of how I wanted to shape this book. I was aware that I've written 3 books before this, all American travel books, poems, and I wrote very much in what William Carlos Williams called the American grain. And he was in the beginning of the 20th century, you know, lamenting the fact that Eliot would turn to Europe and to other cultures and not pay attention so much to America. And Walt Whitman was also in my mind, who in the 19th century was trying to shape an American literature at all. And so he was turning away from European culture as well. So there was a whole history in American literature of trying to shape an American literature, not going to Europe, not paying attention to other cultures. And so, you know, I'm post both of those guys, but I was aware that those were voices in my head, and I was also aware that my own first 3 books had been very American books. So while I was doing all this American travel, I had the good fortune of also being able to travel abroad. And I finally wanted to collect them into a volume. So as I was doing that, I collected all the foreign travel poems into a collection, which came to be this one, Travel on Travel. And but I had a lot of the voices in my head already that were naysaying. And so I used them very consciously. Williams, Whitman, they start section 1. At first it was just kind of, in a chaotic sense that I had a lot of voices, but little by little I decided, as I already explained earlier, that I was going to use that the book was going to be ordered around a kind of a journey from youth to age. And when I started thinking about the first section having a heavily kind of initiation experiences, sensory information, I thought that's a good place to put Williams and Whitman's mm-hmm. quotes. So they come at the beginning in part because they are those kinds of writers, and I find commonality with their writing. And yet, I'm putting it to different ends. In a way, I'm having a sort of argument with them, or I'm just showing, yes, the same kinds of properties of a good poem can be used, the kind of reportage that Whitman used to describe Manhattan and Brooklyn in the 19th century can do the same thing in a very long poem about China called Rot and Blossom that I have here. And so I was using some of the same poetic elements of craft, but applying them to a different task.
Right.
So I did that for each section. Robinson Jeffers, again, who had no use for American empire and just sort of thought about all the downsides of aggression. I use him in the second section where I am looking at various foreign conflicts and looking at many poems about walls and what walls mean, divisions and, you know, property and ultimately wars and mm-hmm. battlements. And so, you know, I chose the Jeffers quote very carefully, and I wanted to move on to art and culture, and Wallace Stevens came to mind. He is a poet of the imagination. And on we go. And Edgar Allan Poe is in the fourth section with a quote about death and beauty, because in my book, those are poems about death, except all the death is taking place in foreign places. And in fact, Edgar Allan Poe had another quote in which he said, you know, unless a book has an imprint of having been, you know, published in London or Paris or Rome, and it's very hard to, you know, for readers to want to read it. And this was in, you know, the 19th century. But so, you know, he was also kind of wanting to be focused on America and making an American literature. And then finally, Emerson, who, you know, says something about, I forget the exact quote, but it's about the kind of focus or locus of divinity is within inside each of us, and America is the final place to make contact with divinity. And so I use that, and of course all of my poems were about spirituality and divinity in other places, as far-flung as, why not, Italy, with all of its Duomos and, you know, religious iconography,
yeah.
And as well as the Marquesas with two pow-pow black ghosts who sort of inhabit that island still, they believe, even though they're now all converted to French Catholicism. There is an overlay of that, and then underneath it, I think, still is their indigenous culture and religion, their belief in ancestor worship, and their belief in the whole spirit world, among which are these black ghosts who visit the island. So I tried to just, you know, apply some of the epigraphs, the quotes from American writers, and apply them now in new situations and contexts.
Great. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I do want to ask you to read one more poem from this collection before we move on to talking about Vermont exit ramps. I want to talk about the ancient walls of San Guzme. I loved this poem, and I thought, well, we'll talk about it maybe after you read it.
Okay. The Ancient Walls of San Guzme. Why is it in the little town of San Guzme, amid the clatter of dinnerware and clink of Chianti bottles, amidst the heavy laughter and gruff oaths and loud overtures and postures of Italian lawyers at law, when one man scraped back his chair, arose, and clicked over the clay tiles to the grand piano, the room already began to hold its breath. And when he played a schmaltzy popular tune, just well enough for us to recognize it, still it quieted us and reminded us of the quiet outside, the off-season cobblestone, the medieval walls close around us, and what they were for. And another loudness that had saltpeter and blood in it. And though the tune was only competent, it was good enough to remind us where we were, how far we'd come, how far we could fall in a loud, unmindful instant. Then one lawyer said he could see in my face I was Yiddish. He could see I was an artist, and artists have suffered. I liked him very much for this, didn't like him for that. When I played on the piano a jazzy version of Rock of Ages, his table applauded. Then he stood, uninvited, made a formal speech about we Americans, about the Yiddish, and claimed he was an Italian lawyer up from Roma with a little pension just above the ristorante where the aroma of pasta overpowered him. You see me here, he said, entirely surrendered, as many of us have done over the years. And what was the basis of our friendship? That we were the only two tables on an October afternoon in San Guzme? That a few tunes on the piano, one from their table, one from ours, had sealed our bond as solidly as a king's ring impressed in wax? No one was going to the gallows after a final meal. No one would be betrayed. He wanted my book of poetry, trusting it would be a good book, if not the good book. Why will I never visit him, never trust him, he who is more warmly human than my American manners allow? Why do I sniff a trap where there is no trap? Is there?
Thank you. I loved a lot about this poem. I loved the sense of the displaced tourist and how, as human beings, we have this need to connect with our fellow human beings, even strangers from other cultures who we are in a place for a little while with, you know. Leading us to make friends in unlikely moments. And then I also wondered if you could talk a little bit about the influence of self-reflection in these poems and the importance of sort of like looking at yourself in another place.
Well, travel does take us out of our usual context and our usual routines and habits. And so from the start, I think it asks us to reconsider who we are in relation to the world around us. And since the world has changed, you know, we have new contexts to measure ourselves against. And sometimes in when a place is very noisy, you know, for instance, in the poem about Ubud, Bali, where there was so much going on and there was a lot of noise and a lot of hustle and bustle, I didn't immediately think about who I was in relation to them, even though it was everywhere apparent. But sometimes in a quiet place, such as San Gosme, where it was just, you know, our table and their table, and our habits were very different. Very quickly, I'm aware of the distance between us. And I'm also aware, especially when I don't normally, my modus operandi isn't to immediately go and try to make acquaintances or friendships with the out there. If it seems possible, plausible, easy, I'll do it. But a lot of times I'm not the kind of person who goes over and charismatically tries to make my way into their space. But these people
friendliness, though.
Okay. Perhaps the way I've described it makes it easier to say that. In any case, yes, they were of that nature that they really did want to know who we were.
Right.
They heard us speaking English and wanted to befriend us in whatever way. And, you know, so at a very basic level, immediately I'm aware of the differences in the way we inhabit our own bodies, the space between us, how we navigate social relations, and how we try to patch together a conversation using several languages. We spoke French better than Italian, and so we tried to find, you know, another language in which we both had enough grasp so that we could talk when they ran out of English and when we ran out of Italian. So there are a lot of ways one's navigating social relation and one's reapproximating one's own personality in the process. Beyond that, the circumstances in this poem are on the surface. You know, there aren't too many ripples, but I think deeper down, some of the things, you know, he was saying about, identifying me as Jewish, as Yiddish, and then saying, you know, I expect yours will be a good book, if not the good book. And, you know, identifying himself as Christian. And then this comment about we've all surrendered, you know, you see me here, we entirely surrendered to this place, as many of us have done over the years. There was a strange way he said it. And I was perhaps thinking about, you know, that piece of history in Italy and France and Germany and the Second World War and capitulations of governments, the Vichy government in France. There's a way in which they surrendered to an evil that its project was to annihilate the Jewish people. So that's sort of back there, way back in the midst of the poem. And there's also something about walls, again.
Yeah.
And how it's quiet, but I say, but the walls are nearby, and it reminds us that there of other loudnesses before it, and one that had saltpeter and blood in it. Saltpeter is a major component of gunpowder. And so there are ways in which I'm trying to suggest a little bit of the violence back of the silence.
Yeah.
And that's why by the end I'm wondering or not whether there's a trap
is
there a trap or isn't there.
Yeah. But I love the way you went into that, where it's sort of like, why do I see a trap where there isn't one? Is there?
Yeah.
It was like,
and even a line like, that our friendship with no one. How's it go? A few tunes on the piano, one from their table, one from ours, had sealed our bond as solidly as a king's ring impressed in wax. No one was going to the gallows after a final meal. Suddenly, that shift. Even the king's ring suddenly makes me start thinking of a past time in which a king could order an execution very quickly. And so, yes, all of those things are layered into the poem.
Okay, great. Okay. I am loath to move on because there are so many fabulous poems in here, but we do have another collection I want to talk about, and that is Vermont Exit Ramps, which is a collection of poems that you write about the different exit ramps, some of the different exit ramps in Vermont, not all, and then you have a few that are not specific to exit ramps, but or just a couple, I think. So I wonder if we can start by talking a little bit about the collection, how it came to be, and then maybe you can read the opening poem.
Sure. Well, as you say, the Vermont Exit Ramps book is about what else? Vermont Exit Ramps. And how did it come to be? I've always loved driving the highways of Vermont, and unlike other, parts of the world where exits aren't that special. I think, Vermont has these, first of all, the highway system is gorgeous, as we all know.
Yeah.
And the little land off the exits is very mysterious to me. It was at one point, it was all sort of gouged by, bulldozers, and then it recovered. And so no one's allowed on those places anymore. When you, enter any exit, entrance, egress, and you see signs that say no pedestrians, no hitchhikers, no picking up hitchhikers, no farm vehicles, no snow machines, no horses, and so nobody is allowed on these places. So they have, in a way, regenerated on their own, unimpeded by human activities. And there is wildlife that has reclaimed these places. Okay, why did I write about them? Because I'm often driving on these roads, but it's also at the end of a school year, and usually my creative input suffers seriously as I go into the year, and by the time May rolls around, the end of the school year, serious attrition has taken place. And I feel ravaged, and I'm looking to be recovered, just as a highway exit was ravaged and recovered. And so I started, I often go for drives trying to regenerate. I just had this sense that I would go out driving along the exits and maybe stop and see what was at each one. And I did this, it was the third week of May, a series of days, I think the 18th through the 20th. And I ended up doing this for 3 years. And I did it on the same days each year. And so I went back to these exits, three times, not once.
Oh, so you did all these exits in that period of time.
Yeah.
Three times.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wouldn't swear to having gone to every one each time, but over the 3 years, I visited several of them several times. And I did that in part because I was trying to get the sense of the same flora and fauna at that moment in May when migration's happening and certain things are in bloom. And, of course, you can't account for the weather, nor are some of the activities that are there, so you can't control everything.
Right, and how seasons are changing so quickly.
Right. But so I went at first just to be an observing eye along the exit ramps. And it was really, I started calling them generically ramplands, the ramplands. Mm-hmm. And my initial impulse was just to describe what I saw there, sort of natural history of the ramplands. But over time, I started thinking, well, each of these exits has a history. There are names, Montpelier, Waitsfield, Warren, and so forth. And each exit has a history very nearby, a public history. And then, of course, I've lived in the state off and on for 40 years, hitchhiked a lot when I was younger, and visited and then drove, to many of these exits many times to visit friends and lovers and so forth. And so I have personal history with the Vermont exits as well. And I started seeing that I would overlay on the descriptions of natural history, personal history, and public history. And pretty soon what had started just as perhaps observation maybe lyric poem or story, a narrative poem, became collage. And that's really what happened. The nature of this, or the style of this book, is more collage than anything. And so a collage is those three things that I just said, the natural history, personal history, and public history. And then those things being so determined, I was also wanting some serendipity to enter into the poems, some play. And I did that by doing anagrams.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, so I fed the names of the towns, like Stowe, into an anagram scrambler, said, give me all 2- and 3-word permutations of it, and came up with, like, so wet, or to sew, or in Montpelier, it becomes triple omen, or P-lit morn, or something like that. And the other things, some of the exits, there are Chinese restaurants nearby, and I just started taking fortune cookie fortunes and from them, and sort of rather randomly choosing one for each exit ramp. Over time, it was more arranged.
Wow.
I also used signage, the do not merge or merge early. I used bird calls as interpreted by Tori Peterson guides, and Roger Tori Peterson, and other things, so that there's an accumulation of stuff from various places that all are layered together into Vermont and into these exit ramps. And there's a geological level as well. The granite, the geological formations are referenced as well. And so this is the way I see Vermont.
Yeah,
And it's not a pastoral image. That we've already done that. Robert Frost did that. This is really purposely post-pastoral. Yeah, there's bucolic imagery, but it's also, there's a lot of imposition of the human, the plasticization of culture.
Yeah.
There are malls and everything else that we think we require that has bedeviled us, in this modern time. And so those things are all overlaid.
Okay.
And that is the modus operandi of the Vermont exit ramps.
And I was going to have you read the opening poem, but actually I'm wondering, how about, would you read the poem about Stowe, I-89 Stowe?
Sure.
We'll talk a little bit about that one.
Okay.
Okay.
So I started with Stowe because I live in Johnson, Vermont, and I access the highway by going down Route 100 to Stowe, and that's where I started, exit 10. And I went south rather than north because there's more bucolic, landscape south rather than going up toward Burlington.
Burlington doesn't get an exit.
Yet, but I have all new exit ramps for yet another book, and I'm hoping it will not only be a Vermont exit ramp too, but maybe I'll just put them all together into a full book. This is a chapbook.
Okay.
And they have these cumbersome two-line titles, I-89, Stowe Waterbury, Exit 10, Route 100, May 18th, 11 a.m., full sun. That is the title.
Okay.
Blasted through 50 feet of granite to make this exit Vermont, quote-unquote, for tourists. Unless you believe, you will not understand. What don't we know? The history behind every opportunity. The swelled chests of road crews, so wet, their sweat drips into hot tar. The burned shoulders, explosives, divorces from long days laying road. Never mind. Your assignment is to sew a story together. Delicate hands, but the thread must be strong. Your assignment is history. The summit house, built as the Civil War broke out. The toll road to the top of Mansfield, finished in 1870. The big hotel that swelled across downtown, burned to the ground in 1889. Movement is another exit down the road. Elsewhere, we say. This history has snow in it, and a Swedish family in 1913 who swished through town on long, narrow wooden boards with upturned ends. The locals took to the strange transportation and skiing found a home in Stowe. This history has a moneyed glide, a shush through powder, a hot tub view, and a gold club perched high on a hillside. Beneath it, loggers felling trees on a ski slope, road crews with sledgehammer, pickaxe, demolition dynamite. This history has architect upon architect drawing plans before the plans you produce in the space of a poem. Granite before you thought of granite. granite before the dynamite blast, before the tourist idea, Best Western Cafe Grill, Blush Hill Country Club, Stowe Street Emporium, ATM.
Great.
So you see the highway signs. I just took them straight off. As you come into that exit, you will see those four things with the Best Western Cafe Grill there. And I also took, like, where it says the locals took to the strange transportations, King found home in Stowe. That's italicized. I took that off their website.
Right.
So I did a lot of research by either going to the local library and getting books out, or going to the websites, or getting pamphlets. And so a lot of this is appropriated information.
Yeah. And you also italicized those anagrams, which was fun because
that's good. So
like
wet
that.
And to sew.
Yeah.
And I also italicized the fortune cookie. Unless you believe, you will not understand. So
there are a few poems in this collection that aren't tied to a certain exit. They are perhaps more reflections that you've had about the countryside or memories of places that you've been here. So one of those is Turn in Guildford, and I wondered if you could, maybe we can finish up by your reading that poem.
Sure, thanks. Most of the poems are, as you say, collage poems, and then there are a couple that are either, they just arose in a different way, either out of a memory and they became narratives, or others were almost like sort of oracular moments that became lyric poems. And there are three or four of those spread out across the pages, actually trying to create the idea of sections or the feel of sections. But this poem, Turn in Guildford, was a complete narrative poem with a complete memory behind it. The events of the poem are somewhat, some autobiographically so, and some invented, and I'll leave you to decide which are which.
That's not fair.
Okay. Turn in Guildford. No exit here, just a recurring curve of memory. Turn south. Drive with me a while down Route 5 to a blind rise, high grass, sweeping curve to Guildford, where my youth almost took a U-turn. Almost flipped to a shattered windshield, shattered life, when my VW bug lifted a boy off his feet, rolled him over my yellow hood, bumped him against the glass, and launched him 50 feet in flight to the roadside grass, where he bounced once and lay still, his elbow poking through skin. And soon his pain and shock and consternation on my face, and a bristling crowd at my back as I tried to keep the boy awake, alert, stern looks from the men who'd have chopped my hippie hair and run me down and told police to lock me up. Until the mother arrives, calm as a willow over a still pool, beautiful as a whisper, and rests a cool hand on my shoulder and coos the boy out of shock. Coos me too out of the darkest place where I'm marked forever by a death. Mark of Cain, overruling any accident. No accident can undo the damage of a dead youth. And her hand is on my face, saying grace, saying he'll survive. Your penance is dinner at our house in a week. And I'm there on a day of atonement, the boy with his mending arm in a sling, the mother cooking and humming, and all of us gracious at dinner, counting the blessings, recounting the tale again. I saying, the boy must have felt a white jolt of pain. The boy saying, no, the shock blocked it, and his mother must have suffered more. And she saying, no, no, turning to me and saying, it was this driver who must have suffered most. And then we went to bed, she in her early motherhood, and I, a college kid, deep in my mea culpas, eager for the body's rhythm of remorse and the cum cry's absolution, eager to nudge aside the boy and kneel for her blessed hand on my head. In the next room, he must have heard us. Oh, the accident, and oh, and what did I know? What did I know of a mother's love? She held me like a child.
Thank you very much for reading that. So that's Neil Shepherd reading Turn in Guildford from Vermont Exit Ramps. So how was this chapbook put out? I wanted to just mention a publisher or whomever.
It has a somewhat troubled history, but it was accepted for publication by Pudding House Press, which has been publishing chapbooks for 40 years, and this was in galley proof when the publisher dropped dead. And that was the end of that run. So I very quickly turned to this other publisher, a Big Table Publishing Company in Boston.
Okay.
I had done some blurbs for her previously on other chapbooks, and I liked the kind of book she put out. So, and she'd actually asked me if I had a chapbook, and I had told her that I was publishing it elsewhere. When that fell through with Pudding House, I contacted her, and she said, send it over. And very quickly, we turned it around, and it came into being as a chapbook. If you take a look at it, unlike most chapbooks, which are either saddle-stitched or stapled, this actually has a spine, albeit a very small one, which the cover artist, Ken Leslie, who's a faculty member at Johnson State College, where I used to teach. Ken and I have worked together before, and it's really a kind of fanciful spine.
Yeah.
It's basically goes from a no-passing zone. It's two yellow lines, a solid double line, and then going to a passing zone, and then full passing zone. And so that became the spine of the book. If you can't have your name and the title on it, at least you can do something clever.
Do something clever.
Yeah. So that's how the book came into being.
And the cover's wonderful. And it's Big Table Press?
It's Big Table Publishing Company. Out of Boston, Massachusetts.
All right. Well, Neil Shepherd, thank you so much for speaking with me today. This was a pleasure.
It was a pleasure for me as well. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Neil Shepherd. His sixth book of poetry, Hominid Up, will be published by Salmon Poetry Press out of Ireland in the spring of 2015 in time for the AWP conference. Divided into two sections, Hominid Up reflects the bifurcated concerns of Shepherd's recent life, spending half the year in New York City and half in northern Vermont. You can read more about Neil Shepherd's work on his website, neilshepherd.com. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic gigabit network. And VCAM, with a mission to enrich civil discourse in the Chittenden County region by providing local citizens with access to training and state-of-the-art digital media tools as a means of personal, political, and artistic self-expression. More information at vermontcam.org. I've decided to skip the Bookworm's calendar this week in favor of sharing extra prompts from Neil Shepherd. The fact is I'm running over anyway, but these are great prompts. I asked him if he might have a writing prompt to share, and he offered four, which is just wonderful. It's great when you work with teachers because they use a lot of these exercises. So the first of these four prompts focuses on poetic identity. Select at least six items from the choices below and mix them into an identity poem that reveals who you are, or some disguise of you, or some totally fictional you. Add whatever other language you need to patch the disparate parts of the poem together. So here's the list. Briefly describe a significant or recurring dream. What is your totemic animal and why? Which element, earth, air, fire, or water, are you and why? Borrow a phrase from a famous poem that fits your identity. Use a guidebook on flowers, trees, birds, or stars to discover a few natural objects that correspond to your identity. Feed your full name into an anagram, Scrambler, and select a few phrases that seem to describe you. What truths do you live by? Be specific. What lies do you live by? Again, be specific. If you could be anybody who has lived on this earth, who would it be? If you could be a fly on the wall, where would you like to land? If you could be a ghost, who would you like to haunt? What is your secret power and your secret weakness other than kryptonite? So that was the first of four exercises or writing prompts that Neil Shepherd shared with me. The second focuses on sentence rhythms. Write a prose paragraph or a poetic stanza whose sentences try to imitate the rhythm of one of the following activities. A truck driver riding a big rig across the Great Plains. A machine operating in a factory. A couple having sex. A religious sermon. A ping pong match. A roller coaster ride. A skydive. An interrogation scene, either at a police station or in a courtroom. You know, pause for these emergency vehicles. Okie dokie. Okay, the third prompt is for dreamers. Oh my goodness. Lots of emergency vehicles. All right. The third prompt is for dreamers. Write a poem based on a few of your dreams that still don't make sense to you. Try to pluck out the most arresting images from those dreams. Then insert them in a poem about some normal, in quotes, domestic activities such as shopping at the supermarket, swimming laps at the pool, studying for an exam, flossing your teeth, or cleaning your room. The cognitive dissonance between dream image and daily activity should create the surreality of the poem. And then the last prompt is for writers who are bored with, quote, the self, end quote. The poet Philip Levine has said about the autobiographical impulse, why would we want to write about ourselves if we can imagine and write about anybody else in history? So Neil Shepherd suggests for this exercise, adopt a historical figure, someone decidedly not you, who lived at least 100 years ago. Research that person, the historical period, the dramatic events central to the poem you will write, and then write the poem from this person's perspective and voice. Remember to make the poem vivid, that's the word, vivid, and externalized. Don't create an abstract monologue that neglects references to the time, place, characters, and events of this historical period. And he says it helps to imagine a dramatic moment in time. So there you go, four prompts from Neil Shepherd. He suggested I pick one to share, but they are all so good, I decided to just go with all of them. Good luck with these exercises, and please listen next week for another. And of course, they will be on the podcast site if you weren't able to write quickly enough. If you're interested in sharing the outcome of a writing prompt from the show, please email me at writethebook@gmail.com. If you'd like to share the show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. If you have a guest to suggest, comments about the show, news about book-related events, or a writing prompt to share with me, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. That means volunteers and donations. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. It's been a pleasure to be with you this Monday afternoon. I am Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.